Good afternoon. It is one bell of the afternoon watch. And this is your Captain Joe up in the captain's chair on the magical isle of Vashon. The sun is shining. It is a beautiful winter day here on the magical isle. And my greetings today go out to all people who come from or have served on the American Great Lakes. If you served on the lakes but did not come from there originally, or if you come from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, or you come from any place else that is on or near or around the American Great Lakes or have served there, my greetings in particular go out to you today. And the reason for this is that over the week, I have been the privileged recipient of the ice charts for the Great Lakes. And the ice charts are showing me there are a number of colors that tell us the amount of ice and the not only the amount of ice, but the intensity of it. And the most intense are red, and the red is starting to fill in on all of the Great Lakes. John, J-O-N, John, sends me these ice charts, and I am very grateful to have them. And that said to me, I think it's time for me to tell a couple of Great Lakes stories from my own experiences, because I am one of the few people in either the Coast Guard and certainly the Navy who is experienced both as a blue water, saltwater sailor, and also a freshwater sailor in the Great Lakes. So most of the rest of this broadcast is going to be taken up with some of the stories and some of my experiences as a Great Lakes sailor. The binnacle list today has one new entry, and that is our friend and colleague John, J-O-H-N, John, who is one of the administrators for the Coast Guard Channel, and who had not made an appearance on the channel for several days, and so we were all very much concerned. And one of the other administrators, the same John who provides me with the ice charts, was able to track John down and to determine that he has some pretty serious things going on. I'm not going to get into the details of what those serious things are yet, because I've not had a signal directly from John himself, but it'd be enough to say that we are all concerned enough that it is time for him to go on to the binnacle list and for all of us to send in his direction the concentrated energy of which we are capable. In my own case, I have had two sessions with the people who helped to take care of me and who help get me up into the captain's chair with you every week. Both of those were successful passages. Both of them were successful meetings. My numbers, various marker numbers, are as close to normal as we would hope for someone of my chronological years. I do say that it is not yet time to be practicing the flag folding ceremony. In this week that we're just starting, today is Tuesday, and later on this week, I have two more sessions, and one is with my oncologist, and that will determine whether or not we decide to go forward with yet another infusion of the magic elixir known as Lupron. And I believe that that's probably what's going to happen, and that is what is holding the dreaded cancer at bay, keeping it from spreading, and allowing me to continue to come up into the captain's chair with you each week, and in fact to begin my travel plan for this year, the year of 2026, in which we observe the 250th birthday of the great republic that all of us serve in one way or another. Before I get into my Great Lakes stories, I am announcing that along with the glacier, which is named for your captain, the Wubbo Glacier on the Antarctic Peninsula, and you can find it by typing in Wubbo Glacier into any worldwide map program like Google Earth, and it will come right up, and you'll see that it is not only there, it's snow covered, but that it is not receding. So along with the Wubbo Glacier and along with the Wubbo Room in Scott Polar Research Institute in the Shackleton Memorial Library, I have now discovered that there is a hotel in Germany, and it is called the Fahrenhof Wubold. And it is in a town of Rieste, R-I-E-S-T-E, in Lower Saxony. It is a farm hotel due east of Amsterdam. And I am going to send them a signal and say, you have a namesake. Now, I happen to know that the first Wubbold came to America in 1870. And somewhere in my records, I even have the name of the ship in which he came to America. And I don't know the circumstances that all of that happened, but I do know that my ancestor came in 1870, and he came from probably someplace not too far from Rieste. So I'm going to send them a signal and say that there is a Wubbo, in fact, several now because of my son and my grandchildren, that is in residence here in America, and that I may well come and book a stay in Fahrenhof Wubbold, which is about 100 clicks to the east of Amsterdam. And I'll be going to Amsterdam in May with my son and daughter-in-law. So the Great Lakes stories go something like this. First of all, Captain, how was it that you went to the Great Lakes in the first place? In the winter of 1978, I believe it was, I was captain in the Coast Guard cutter Northwind, my much-loved Northwind. And she was in the dry dock at the Coast Guard Yard in Baltimore, on the upside of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, by the way. Had to go through the Key Bridge to get out into the bay to head south, and then from there to Antarctica. And it was in November, and we were getting ready to deploy. 3 o'clock in the morning, the telephone, and I was living in the ship because we were getting ready to deploy, and I did not have a wife or family with me at that time. It was before Mary and I were together. And so I was living in the ship, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, the telephone in the captain's cabin rang. And it was my admiral. It turns out that this, of course, is the same admiral who had been with me when he came on patrol with me and when I was captain in Unimac up to the Grand Banks on a fisheries and drug patrol. But I've told that story before here, and that's another story for another time. By this time, he was the commander of the 5th Coast Guard District with his headquarters in Portsmouth, and I reported to him. I had worked for him before. He knew me well. He's crossed his own bar. He was a brown shoe, a Coast Guard aviator, wearer of the wings of gold. And it was 3 o'clock in the morning. My telephone rang and I picked it up. And I think that I had been ashore investigating Christian Science reading rooms. And so it took me just a minute to realize who was on the other end of the line. And he said, "Captain Joe, this is Admiral Johansson." "Good morning, Admiral. 3 o'clock in the morning. Most of the time, Coast Guard aviators are not up and about then unless they're on a rescue mission. What could be going on at 3 o'clock in the morning?" Admiral said, "Captain Joe, when can you get underway?" And I said, "If the Yardbirds," that is not a pejorative term, it is just one which is used by Coast Guard people about people who work in shipyards. I said, "If the Yardbirds button the ship up and put her back in the water, I can be underway by tomorrow evening, and I will be able to get underway only on one engine and one propeller, but if they will put Yardbirds on the ship with me, then, and they can work on the ship as we go down Chesapeake Bay because I need to fuel her at Craney Island near Norfolk. And so I can be underway by this evening, today." After all, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. And he said, "Well, you don't have to be underway that early, but how about in 3 days? And I said, "Done. I will get together with the ship superintendent, known as the ship soup, and I will ask you to get in touch with the commanding officer of the yard, and we lay out a quick plan as to how we get the ship buttoned up and get her ready to go to sea. What could this mission be?" And he said, "Your sister ship, West Wind, up in the Great Lakes, has run aground and opened herself up. She ran aground on Detour Reef, which is at the entrance to the St. Mary's River. And the St. Mary's River connects Lake Huron and Lake Superior and connects to the locks at the Sioux, Sioux St. Marie." And he said, "She's run aground. The bottom has been ripped out of her. They've done some repairs. She's going to be able to sail, but she's going to come out of the Great Lakes and go to the Coast Guard Yard. And the admiral commanding the Great Lakes District, the 9th Coast Guard District, desperately needs a replacement. And I am going to send you if you can get underway right away so that you can beat the closing of the St. Lawrence Seaway, the Welland Canal, and get up into the 9th District to Cleveland." And I said, "Admiral, you've got it. I have a crew that will do this, that will be able to do this. You have my word on it. You have my hand on it." And so that's what we did. And that morning, I had a new XO. I had lost, within the normal rotation, the XO that had been with me in Antarctica, and I had a number of, because I had been in Antarctica the winter before, and I had a number of new people who had not been with me at sea before, but I had enough of a cadre of my Antarctic crew that they knew my ways, and they knew that if I made a commitment on their behalf, that they had the obligation and the privilege to fulfill that commitment. So I knew that I could make this commitment and that we would make it happen. So that morning, I got hold of XO, my new XO. I will not further characterize this gentleman. He has himself crossed the bar. But I will say this. He had been sent to me to get some sea time. He was not a ship driver. He was not in that specialty. He was in another Coast Guard specialty. And he was not an experienced ship handler, and he was not experienced working a crew. And so I had never been on a mission with him yet, so I didn't know exactly how he was going to handle the instructions that he was about to receive. So that morning, I got I had XO come up to the cabin and I said, XO, get ready for this because you have got a great big job. We are deploying north into the Great Lakes rather than south to the Antarctic. And in order to make all of this happen, you, XO, are going to reorganize ship's company. And I explained to him what had happened, and I explained to him what we were going to do. I said, you, XO, are going to reorganize ship's company from three sections into four sections, and one of those sections in rotation will be able to be at our home port in Baltimore, that's how it's pronounced by people that come from that part of the world, Baltimore. And so I said, that's your task, get out. And when you hold quarters this morning, I want you to have me hold quarters, because my custom was then and would be today that when I had difficult things to pass on to my crews, I always did that myself. And I said, after you have mustered quarters, I want you to have everybody fall out and gather around me, and I will tell them what has happened, what we're going to do, and how we're going to do it. And in the meantime, you need to get all the department heads, division officers, and chiefs together and start reorganizing the ship into those four sections. So on the flight deck that morning, I held quarters, and captains don't usually hold quarters. They don't usually go to quarters. But that day inside the hangar, I was the one that held quarters. And my crew, of course, by this time knew that something significant was up. And I explained what had happened with Westwind. I explained what was going to happen with us. And I said, and we're going to be getting underway in 3 days. And we're going to take Yardbirds with us down the bay to Craney Island to fuel. And these Yardbirds are going to work with ship's company to get the engines back up, because we're going to get underway with just one out of four main engines and only one propeller. And you could see the crew kind of shifting around. But the people who had been with me before had been with me through some real adventures, and nobody wanted to miss anything. And I knew that the word would get from them to the new people, and that I would have a crew that was ready to take on anything that could happen. The big unknown for me, of course, was the quality and the abilities of my new XO. So I told the crew that we would be reorganizing into four sections, and that at any given time, one-fourth of the crew would be in home port. And this would happen in rotation. And I said, the way we're going to do this is that I've arranged with Admiral Johansson, who is our 5th District boss, and we'll arrange with Admiral Scarborough, who will be our 9th District boss, to have C-130 flights to move ship's company around as necessary. So to carry on with the story would take much more time than I have, and I'm just looking at my large watch, and I see that I'm running out of time already. So it'd be enough to say that we did indeed, within those 3 days, get underway, that we got underway on one screw and one engine, and getting her through the bridges from the Coast Guard Yard, and then through the bridge at the Francis Scott Key Bridge, but getting her through the bridges at the Coast Guard Yard was pretty tricky, just on one propeller. But we did it, and we went down the bay, and all the way down the bay, I had all of these Yardbirds, and they were beavering away getting the engines put back together and running all the tests and checks. And by the time we got to Craney Island to fuel, we had everything up and rolling, all four running, both screws turning, everything going. All of the Yardbirds had made a lot of extra money. I don't know if they got CPAY, but they all made a lot of extra money. They'd been well fed. They had integrated completely with my engineering force to get the ship ready to go. Once we fueled, we headed out through the Virginia Capes and then up and through the St. Lawrence Seaway and through the Welland Canal and through each one of the locks. As we went through the locks, we were the last ship. The Coast Guard had worked with the Lake Carriers Association and with the Seaway Authority to keep everything open for us so that we could get through, and we were the last ship through for the season. And as we went through each lock master said, "Captain, we'll see you in the spring." What I did not know at that time was that the spring wasn't going to come until sometime in May of the following year. And all the way through the Seaway and all the way up into the Great Lakes and all the way through Lake Erie and Lake Ontario and then Lake Erie and Lake Huron, through all of those lakes, we broke ice. It was a brutally cold winter. The ship behaved magnificently. The crew was equally magnificent. I never left anybody behind that was not planned to be left behind. Nobody wanted to miss anything. And it was not only a great experience, but it was a great demonstration of the kind of thing that the Coast Guard and its predecessor organizations have done since 1790. And when you have a crew that believes in the operating philosophy and they know that they're going to be, that they and their families are going to be taken care of as well as can be done, then they are capable of incredible performance. And that's exactly what happened. Northwind ran with the engines turning and the propellers turning 95% of the time. And the only time that we stopped was to lay alongside to fuel. And we had to fuel from tank trucks, and we usually fueled in the Sioux, pulled up alongside the base in the Sioux, which I did not know it at the time. The following summer, I was going to command. Well, there are lots of Great Lakes stories, but I'm going to get to a couple of other things before I run out of time. It'd be enough to say that my experience as a freshwater sailor, for one thing, distances are not measured in nautical miles. They are measured in statute miles. Speeds in the water are measured as miles per hour rather than knots. And and there is no book today. But I am recommending that if you are interested in the Great Lakes and you're interested in Great Lake shipping, that there are many, many really good books that you can get from your local bookstore or from Barnes & Noble. I highly recommend Barnes & Noble. And if all else fails, go on to Amazon. But or go to your local library and just check out some books, because the ships that sail on the Great Lakes are incredibly interesting ships. And, for example, there is a type of ship called a whaleback, sailed only in the American Great Lakes, maybe the Canadian side as well, but certainly the American Great Lakes. To my knowledge, there are none of them saved. My Great Lakes historian, John, J-O-N, will tell me if there is one anywhere in the lakes. I don't think so. I think they've all been scrapped. But there are lots of photographs of them, and they are very, very interesting ships. The Great Lakes is also the ships where there was a social distinction, where the deck force was all the way forward and the engineers were all the way aft. And when the ships that are 1,000 feet long were constructed, the first one was the Stuart J. Court, and she was the last of the 1,000-footers to have the deck force forward and the engineers aft. And the next ones that came, 1,000 feet long, had everybody all the way aft, the deck force all the way aft. Edmund Fitzgerald belonged to a class of ships called the Triple A's, and she was the classic deck force forward and engineers aft construction. There are several of her ships still floating, still working today. So I tell you all of this so that you yourself can go and get a couple of the books. The one that I had, which was one of my treasures and had been given to me by a couple who were not Great Lakes people but knew that I was, and both of them have now crossed their bar, and in my necessity for moving things on to other places and with other people, that particular book is headed today to my young friend Cody. A parcel will be headed his way after I end this broadcast. And it will contain a book about Great Lakes ships and Great Lakes shipping. And a book that came to me from much-loved friends who are no longer with me. Thanks to Cody and to the books that I am sending his way, I am now up to 10 books that I have sent on to people that I know will enjoy them and appreciate them. And in turn, when it comes their time, we'll pass them on to somebody else. One of the concerns that I have about what's going on with shipping today is the size of what we call the shadow fleet. This is not Great Lakes stuff now. This is deep water stuff, blue water stuff, salt water stuff. Ships that are under sanction by the United States, which are flying the flags of a number of different countries and are carrying in particular petroleum products that are under sanction and are now being seized under warrants which are issued by U.S. courts and are being seized by Coast Guard ships, Coast Guard cutters. The Shadow Fleet turns out to have in it something like 1,500 vessels. And these are flagged in Russia. Some of them are flagged in the Iranian flag. Some of them are in the Venezuelan flag. We talked about the Venezuelan oil business last week. And the ones which are under sanction and which are being seized are being seized under the terms of warrants, which are issued by federal courts. And they're being seized without loss of life, without anybody being hurt, shot. But they are being seized, and they are causing some great discord in the petroleum business throughout the world. I will be talking a little bit more about that as this whole situation evolves. But I am looking now at my large watch, and I see that I have once again run out of time. There are lots and lots of Great Lakes stories yet to come, but because the ice charts are showing me all of that red, I wanted to start the dialogue between me and you about Great Lakes sailing and especially about Great Lakes winter sailing. And with that, this is your Captain Joe. We never say goodbye. We say until we meet again. And I myself am not only on station and watching properly, but all of the buoys that I check in Puget Sound are on station and watching properly, and all of my lights are watching properly. So this is your Captain Joe. I am on station and watching properly.